So the question I want to ask today is, does God send hard times? Does God do that to us? Are bad times sent from God? Now, if God is in control of everything, then yes, bad times have to come from Him. Unless, of course, He's not in control. And if He's not in control, we really have to adjust our thinking. So, you know, it's something I've struggled with my entire life. And I had an Old Testament professor who always quoted Isaiah 45:7 when this question was asked. He said, this is God talking, and He says, I create the light and make the darkness. I send good times and bad times. I, the Lord, am the one who does these things. That's kind of an interesting verse. And if you look at it in the original Hebrew, it's, I create prosperity and I create disaster. And the word is actually disaster that God says He creates. It's a Hebrew word, ra, and it's nasty. Now, why would God do this? Why would God send bad times to His kids, to His people that He loves more than what we can imagine? Why would He do this? And the only biblical answer you can come up with, really, is He does it to test us, to make us grow. In the New Testament, the book of James, it says this, it says, consider it a sheer gift, friends, when tests and challenges come at you from all sides. You know that under pressure, your faith life is forced into the open, and it shows its true colors. So don't try to get out of anything prematurely. Let it do its work so you become mature and well-developed, not deficient in any way. See, God's purpose is that we grow, that we mature, that we become more Christ-like. You know, if you think about tests, many of us have taken multitudes of tests. I've taken many of them. Tests have always been easy for me because I'm a nerd. You know, and I really enjoy tests. I always have. And what I learned was that if I went through all the material three times, I had it in my head and the test would be easy. So I looked forward to going to take the test. It's the gift of being a book nerd. But what the tests did is they forced me to master the material. And maybe that's why God tests us too. So I want to ask you the question, what big tests have you gone through? Now, what have you gone through? Maybe you're going through a big test right now. Loss can be a huge test. Death of a loved one, huge test. Rejection by a loved one, very huge test. Loss of a job, loss of health. These things are all just plain miserable. There's no way to sugarcoat that. And I found that if I look at these sorts of things as a test, it gives me a whole new perspective. You know, what can I learn through this? Now, I'm going to talk about an American president here, but I'm not making any political statements, okay? I just want to quote his life. This is Franklin Roosevelt, and you see him there in a wheelchair. You know, he contracted polio in 1921. And lost the use of his legs. So anytime you saw pictures of him, he was standing with braces. His legs were completely dead to him. Now, what happened was he said that when he contracted that and lost the use of his legs, he went into a depression, a mental depression that lasted almost a year. And then he decided, you know, maybe this is just a test. And so he ran for governor of New York in 1928 and won right before the Great Depression kicked in 1929. And he said that fighting polio gave him the moxie to stand up to the Great Depression. Well, that was in 1928. In 1932, he ran for president and won. So he had to take the country through this depression, and then World War II started up. And after World War, or toward the end of his life, World War II didn't actually end in his lifetime. He died before it was over. But he said, you know, that the polio, as miserable as it was, toughened him up enough to stand up to Hitler. And so he says, is polio a bad thing or was it a good thing? Now, in the next 5 weeks, six including this one, we're going to talk about two women of moxie, with Ruth and Esther. Today we're going to do the setup for the story of Ruth. And in Hebrew, both Ruth and Esther are called Eshet Hayel, which is, besides being fun to say, you know, Eshet Hayel, it means woman of valor or woman of moxie. And just so we all have our definitions on the same page, having moxie, it's often spelled with a Y, means having courage, determination, and a spirited can-do attitude. Grit is kind of a synonym for moxie. Today we're going to look at Ruth chapter 1 and see how this comes into play. So once upon a time, it was back in the days when judges led Israel, there was a famine in the land. A man from Bethlehem in Judah left home to live in the country of Moab. He and his wife and his two sons. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi. His sons were named Mahlon and Chilion, all Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They all went to the country of Moab and settled there. Now, Moab was considered a foul place by the Jews. It was on the other side of the Dead Sea. And the Moabites were definitely people they wanted to avoid. They had a bad reputation, and they were certainly not always friendly to the nation of Israel. So stay away from those Moabites, you know, that was kind of the thing. But because of the famine, they went there just to be able to raise food. So the story continues. Elimelech died, and Naomi was left, she and her two sons. The sons took Moabite wives. The name of the first was Orpah, the second Ruth. They lived there in Moab for the next 10 years. But then the two brothers, Mahlon and Chilion, died. Now the woman was left without either her young men or her husband. Just an interpretation of this, the name Orpah. We are so tempted to say Oprah. But it's Orpah, and Oprah Winfrey in an interview one time said that her mother insisted it was Oprah and put that on her birth certificate, and there was no talking her mother around it, so she was Oprah, but the correct spelling is Orpah. And that's just, you know, I have ancestors like that too. It was legal for a Jewish man by Jewish law to marry Moabite women. But it was not legal for a Moabite man to marry a Jewish woman. Women were considered property in those days, and your race was determined by your father. So if a Moabite man married a Jewish woman, the kids would be Moabites. But see, the other way worked too. If it was a Jewish man, the kids were considered to be Jews. And that's just how they did things. One day, she got herself together, she and her two daughters-in-law, to leave the country of Moab and set out for home. She had heard that God had been pleased to visit his people and give them food. And so she started out from the place she had been living, she and her two daughters-in-law with her, on the road back to the land of Judah. Then after a short while on the road, Naomi told her two daughters-in-law, "Go back. Go home and live with your mothers, and may God treat you as graciously as you treated your deceased husbands and me. May God give each of you a new home and a new husband." She kissed them, and they cried openly. They said, "No, we're going on with you to your people." We tend to make this sentimental, and it certainly is, but women could not own property. They could not own real estate in those days. And they, since it was an agrarian society, they starved to death if they didn't have a man to provide. Their only options were prostitution and slavery, and quite often that's the way they went. So the narrative continues here. But Naomi was firm. Go back, my dear daughters. Why would you come with me? Do you suppose I still have sons in my womb who can become your future husbands? Go back, dear daughters. On your way, please. I'm too old to get a husband. Why, even if I said there's still hope, and this very night got a man and had sons, can you imagine being satisfied to wait until they were grown? Would you wait that long to get married again? And she was using logic. But what's interesting is that she was interested in the welfare of these Moabite women. Then she goes on and says this, "No, dear daughters, this is a bitter pill for me to swallow, more bitter for me than for you. God has dealt me a hard blow." See, so she's not giving God any slack. She's saying, God did this to me. Today people say, oh, the universe has been unkind to me and that sort of thing. But in the Hebrew, the original idiom is, the Lord has raised his fist against me. And that's how she felt at that time. Again, they cried openly. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth embraced her and held on. Naomi said, look, your sister-in-law is going back home to live with her own people and God's. Go with her. Which is an interesting thing to say. Naomi didn't particularly have any allegiance to the God of Israel, because she said to Orpah, go back to your pagan gods. But Ruth said, don't force me to leave you. Don't make me go home. Where you go, I go, and where you live, I'll live. Your people are my people. Your God is my God. Where you die, I'll die, and that's where I'll be buried. So help me God. Not even death itself is going to come between us. Now, this passage, you may recognize, has been taken out of context hundreds of times because it's a very popular wedding passage. But it's got nothing to do with marriage. If you look at it in its context, it's an agreement, a pact between some widows. It has nothing to do with marriage, but boy, we like to use it as a wedding text. I don't use it for that. When Naomi saw that Ruth had her heart set on going with her, she gave in. And so the two of them traveled on together to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was soon buzzing. Is that really our Naomi? And after all this time, see, small towns still haven't changed. You know, everybody's always in everyone's business. And hopefully it's charitably. But she said, don't call me Naomi. Call me bitter. The strong one has dealt me a bitter blow. I left here full of life, and God has brought me back with nothing but the clothes on my back. Why would you call me Naomi? God certainly doesn't. The strong one has ruined me. So she was defeated. Call me bitter. The strong one took my husband and took my sons, and therefore took her livelihood. Well, did God do it? Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe it was a test. We'll never know. But we can't ask the question, what could she learn from it? You know, Naomi's not the first woman to become a widow. And certainly not the last. So she had to go through the suffering that many of us do. You know, all marriages end either in divorce or death. But the fact is, they all end. So she wasn't that unique, but she was taking a beating for it. So after saying this, she does this. And so Naomi was back, and Ruth the foreigner with her, back from the country of Moab. They arrived in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. So she's facing some tough times, and things did look pretty dark for her. She had no idea of what was ahead for her. She only knew that there was food in Bethlehem. And ironically, Bethlehem means house of bread. Jesus had some things to say about tough times too that kind of match what we see going on here. It's recorded in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 5. It says, you're blessed when you are at the end of your rope. With less of you, there is more of God and his rule. Have you ever been at the end of your rope? Well, lots of us have. It happens all the time. You get to that point where you feel like you have nothing left to lose. And so you have to deal with that. Now, I've been there more than once. I was thinking about that just 2 weeks ago. I'm walking past the Hope College Chapel, and I remember walking past that back in 1982. I was in a really terrible marriage, the kind that you can't imagine, you know. It's why I don't doubt the existence of Satan, because I was married to his sister for a few years. But it was a terrible time. And I couldn't have kids. I wanted a family, but children were not going to be a part of the picture. Now, academically, I was quite successful. I had 5 offers to be a pastor, 2 of which were here in Muskegon, and 1 in Iowa and 2 in South Dakota. So I had these 5 offers, these 5 churches looking at me, but I didn't know if I wanted to be a pastor, because I'm really not pious enough to fit in that role. That was my thinking at the time. And like Naomi, I felt at that point that God has raised his fist to me. Well, that turned out differently than I thought. You know, that was 44 years ago. And then just a few weeks ago on May 16, you know, as I was walking past the Hope College Chapel and the Pillar Church, I realized how much things had changed. You know, from a miserable marriage to not having kids. Then I marry Fertile Myrtle and have 5 kids, you know. And this is the picture we took in the Pillar Church. And I think about that, you know, the sad times, the dark times, and not knowing whether I wanted to be a pastor or not. And so, some days I still wonder that. And there they are, 5 kids and their significant others. Grandkids, the significant others, most of whom I approve. So, you know, it's just kind of an interesting time. What this taught me is that God always has a better plan than anything we can come up with. That I was just shocked at how things had changed. Remembering the dark days of walking past this church, thinking my future was terrible. And then there I stand on the stage in that church with my 5 kids, 3 grandkids, and all that. Things have definitely changed. So I put that into this context, that God's plan is always better than something I can come up with. Now for you, maybe everything is, you know, just peachy in your life right now. Maybe you're living the dream and everything is wonderful. But as I heard one person say just recently, no matter what you're driving, one thing is for certain, it will break down one day. Tough times do come to us all. Franklin Roosevelt was born to wealth and privilege and prestige. Then he got polio. And he realized, because of his polio, that he was called to serve. You're going to get some tough times too. How will you respond? You know, like Naomi, we can have a pity party and say, call me bitter. The Hebrew word for bitter is mara, which is kind of an interesting thing. We'll see that name pop up every once in a while. But Naomi felt sorry for herself, and she had good reason to. But feeling sorry for yourself doesn't get you anywhere. Reporting for duty does. And in the reporting for duty, you are blessed. I've learned this from experience. And it's not easy, but it builds grit. It builds moxie. So we might as well go on, no matter how miserable times are, might as well go on choosing the best path. Because what else are you going to do? You know, the tough times will come. That is inevitable. But how we respond to those times is up to us. Will you blame God and wallow in self-pity, that fails the test. The good news is no failures are final. There's always a lesson that can be learned. I've learned the hard way self-pity doesn't help. There is another way, and that is to report for duty, no matter how painful the situation is that you're in. Because in doing that, you ace the test, and you'll hear eventually, "Well done, my good and faithful servant." Let's pray together. Lord, you have blessed us in ways that we can't even comprehend. And we're thankful for it. So give us the moxie we need to make it through the tests that are before us. And we rely on your blessings and providence as we go through them. Thank you for providing for us. Amen.